You're listening to Cards to the Moon, a podcast about trading cards from both a collector and investor perspective. We hope you'll stick around for the ride as we take a deep dive into the state of the hobby, share some hot takes, hopefully some useful advice, and fun stories along the way. Hey guys, welcome back to Cards to the Moon. This is episode 177. My name is Clark from 5cardguys.com and 5cardguys on Instagram. Co-hosting with me as usual is Hyung of Integrity Sports Cards and John, who is Trade You at Recess. All right, later on in this episode, we have a special guest and good friend who we consider our personal resident Pokemon expert that we've been wanting to have on the pod for a while now. And he's finally agreed to come on the show. His name is Roy, and we'll be asking him a bunch of Pokemon card questions that I think might be interesting, even for sports card collectors and investors. Because what I noticed recently is that in our WhatsApp friend chat group, while most of us who are primarily sports card collectors are talking about how much the market's crashed, Roy, on the other hand, is talking about Pokemon cards that have doubled and tripled in value. So looking forward to learning more about Pokemon cards. And some of these cards, from a collector point of view as well, are actually pretty amazing in their look and design as well. And for me personally, my six-year-old is big into Pokemon cards, so I wouldn't mind knowing which ones to maybe put in top loaders and which ones you can just throw around and play with. So that's also what I'm hoping to learn in our interview. That interview is coming in just a bit, but off the top, I know a lot's been said about the issue of repacks, especially after C. Blaz put out on his IG video recently how it's, in his opinion, overall bad for the hobby. Then we got a bunch of rebuttals saying how it's necessary for the hobby and everything, and everything in between. So maybe we could just spend a few minutes adding our two cents if anyone's curious on our take, and then we can move on and hopefully live happily ever after. I know this has been kind of beaten to the ground. But first, Hyung, I was wondering if you could just explain first what a repack is for people that don't know. What a repack is?
Yeah, so repacks are basically, I guess breakers are more into it, are starting to go towards that. And the repacks are basically where, you know, they create their own, or they buy slabs where they put in maybe 50, 100 packs where people could purchase. It could be any number pretty much. And there's so-called hits within their kind of like repack, right? So you could spend $50, $100, whatever it costs on a particular repack from Breaker or whoever. And you could pull out, something that may be less than the $50, which is your typical common. And then, you could pull out, I guess they would say the chase card or a hit, one of the hits that, can be more than the $50 or $100 buy-in value that a repack sells for. And it could be any amount. It all depends on, the person that is doing the repack or the business or the company. But it's right. Essentially, a way, I guess, what C. Blaz was mentioning that, a lot of these breakers are starting to buy in bulk at a higher comp rate. But for me, I'm in the camp of kind of like it's necessary. And you're going to see more of it because we haven't even talked about Razzes. Like, breaking used to not be a thing too. Like if you go back in time, it started becoming a trend in the hobby. Repacks aren't new. They've been around, for a number of years. I've participated in repacks. I don't really participate today in repacks, but like I've done it. I've hit something great, a repack was $200 and, the person that was organizing the repacks was like, you'll get potentially a slab that's worth at least $200, let's just say. That's what they say, right? And you could, I think we pulled the Jason Tatum Prism PSA 10, and at the time it was worth like $800, right? So for me, I've had good experiences with repacks, not saying that, but it's no different than like, what's the difference between you opening up a box of cards? right? Or entering a break. The repack concept is you're actually, it's a lower risk amount, in my opinion, of just gambling your money away, because you're guaranteed something at least. If you participate in a break or a RAS or have your own box that you're ripping, you come up with nothing. Like 95% of the value you paid could be lost in one of those. Whereas this, you're actually retaining some value, or at least that might be the controversy, right? Are these repackers, you know, fudging things where it benefits them a lot more and the end user a lot less, right? So,
right. I guess that's the main concern, right? Like, whether you could trust the repackers, you know, like, what are their comp values? They're saying, oh, you're going to get at least a guaranteed $200 slap back, but the comp, is it actually $100 for that card?
Right. But for me, you could harp on the details of course, it's not perfect, but this is what we were talking about in previous episodes and my philosophy on why there's, you know, going to be bumps in the road in the hobby, like such as this. But this makes the hobby better. Like, I just looked before this episode what Arena Club is doing. And they have a repack that just released not too long ago. Like, literally, it might be in the last couple days, where everything is tracked. It's very transparent of what's included in the repack. Right? So it's like you know beforehand entering what cards are done, and it's all done through a digital experience. The card is physical, so they would ship the card out to you, but you're entering a repack, you get to open it digitally and see the actual card, and then and you know what cards are in the repack. So if there's a card, they did it by category, like tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, where it's like a $50 pack, a $100 pack, and a $200 pack, and you get three slabs. Right? So for me, the math makes sense on both parts. If, you know, they're buying even at less than comps, you know, you could create that value if you do it properly. And if you have full transparency, I think it's a great experience, to be honest. And I think, who is it? Neo Cards and Comics was saying that it feeds into the whole ecosystem of cards at the end of the day. Breakers, selling singles, all that falls into the ecosystem. So even with people that want to dump their slabs, somebody's picking it up at least, and it's being recycled within the community. That's a necessary, I won't even call it an evil, but like, it's necessary. And companies like Arena Club start figuring out how to make it better, how to make the experience better. And that's what the hobby is all about, in my opinion, is, you know, you go through the bumps. There might be, like I said, Raz City, like back in the day, there might be a better version of, you know, how to do Razes in a more experienced, user-friendly setting. And we don't know where the future is going in terms of all these experiences, right? So for me, I'm for it, because you got companies like Arena Club doing the right thing, in my opinion, providing more value to the hobby in that sense.
Okay. John, what do you think?
So, Clark, when you put this topic up, I know that it's been blowing up on Instagram and social media because I see it everywhere, but I'll admit I didn't bother to click anything or watch anything. So I'm a little confused. Like, C-Bless, I think based on your notes, you said that he argued that dealers prefer to sell to repackers. So are people arguing his point, or now it's just become this thing where people are just arguing repackers in general, or is it a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both, right? I've definitely heard both sides, because the argument from C-Bless is that why would dealers sell to other people like us trying to buy singles at lower comps when they could sell at higher comps to these repackers or these repack businesses? Right, because they could use that for their repacks, and so essentially he's saying that average collectors, it's not good for average collectors because they can't get the cards they want at fair prices. So, and the other side is that, like Hyung was saying, they're saying it's necessary because it does provide liquidity in the market, right? Someone's picking up these slabs that probably no one would want to pick up anyways. But if there is a repacker that does pick it up, then they're pumping money back into the market and it keeps the cycle going. So that's kind of the flip side.
Right.
You know, what's funny is that, you know, based on my experience, and maybe I'm the sucker at a card, Joe, but based on my experience, like if repackers are buying off of dealers at a discounted price, but it's more than, as C. Bless argues, they're selling it more to repackers because it's more than what they would sell to regular. Is that even true? Because when I try to buy off of dealers, like, I'm not paying 70% the comps. There's no way. The dealer has it listed at 150%. And then if I can get him down to 98% of a comp, then I probably won, right?
I think the issue more is like what C. Blaise was saying is like that these repackers are buying at 90% comps and other personal people want to buy at like 80%. Where it's making the comps higher and more expensive than what they're actually worth.
Got it.
Right? Yeah. So I think that's what his argument was.
Yeah. And I'm just jokingly saying, like, I've never seen any dealer give away a card at 80% comp, especially
I think some of the repackers, too, they are known to, especially like Backyard Breaks, they're known to buy whole tables
in one shot.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So they'll do that as well.
Right. And they have a benefit, right? Like these guys who are going out shopping for whatnot, like sports car collector, and like they have content and stuff that they need that requires like the machine to keep rolling, right? So even if they have to pay a little bit extra than they would imagine versus a regular collector, like they got to do it for the content. They got to do it to keep the oil running, right? Or the engine running. So I get it. I think it's in terms of the C Bless part of this, I don't see a problem. Like if I was a dealer, of course, I'm going to sell it to my best customer. If my best customer happens to be a repacker, then so be it. Like, I don't really see the problem. Maybe it goes against, their business of breaking. So I understand there's some frustration for him on a personal level. I don't know. And then repacking in general, like, I mean, I've never gone into a break, but I have bought a repack before, and it was off of Phil Hughes. And you know, I at the time, and he was not that he was in shading or anything, like he was very reputable in the hobby space. I trusted him, and I think it was a pretty expensive repack. And you know, Phil Hughes doesn't collect trash, like he collects some good stuff. So it was off of his like personal collection. I think it was like close to 200 US for a single, and it was a PSA 10 slab. Mm-hmm. And the odds were, I think it was like 80% odds you at least get your money back. Mm-hmm. So for Phil, you know, like imagine any of us, we have all this sort of lower end quantity of cards, like we say, like some trash in our collection that we want to sell and give away. We don't want to do the work of, I don't know, go on eBay, getting hit with the fees and all that. And you can give it away at 100% comps, but you do it in a creative way in repacking. I think it's perfectly fine. And for the consumer, if you find a reputable repacker, the experience of chasing is still there. Like even though it's just one singular rip, one card, I had a lot of fun, and I actually got a card that was worth the money that I paid, right? So you don't feel as bad. I think the negative in the hobby space right now, especially the experience with ripping with kids and with anybody, is the ROI is ridiculous. Like the you know, hobby boxes are 150, 175, 225, 300, 350. Even National Treasures, or you know, like Topps, what was the latest one that came out, like Definitive or whatever, $2,000 a box. Like the odds are you're getting like $100 card worth of cards in that $2,000 box. You're getting $16 worth of base cards in a $300 hobby. So like, if somebody can creatively say, "Hey man, I'm doing repacking. I can guarantee you 50% chance that you're going to at least make your money back." this is a pretty good proposition. And I get there's,
sure.
yeah, there's space for, you know, bad business. People can lie about it. People can put the biggest chase and give that pack secretly to their friend or keep it, mm-hmm. withhold it. Like, I get it. There's, I think there's probably, that's up to you. That's up to you to do your due diligence on what repacker you're, what company you're chasing, all that. I've spoken too much already, but.
No, all valid points. All valid points. And I'll just end off by saying, because you guys mentioned all the main points, but I think at the end of the day, it's trusting in the repacker.
Exactly.
You know, you got to be, they got to be reputable. But also, it's on the repacker side of the business where they are more transparent. You know, like I know some of the suggestions is like, provide a checklist so you know which hits are actually gone.
Oh, that's a good idea. And,
yeah. And then, you know, like I didn't know about Arena Club that Hyung was talking about, but that's another way of doing it, being transparent.
Right.
Everything's digital. I mean, that's kind of what NFTs are. I'm not going to speak more about NFTs because I know that's a trigger word for some collectors, but that keeps track of everything, right? And maybe there's a future in combining NFT technology with repack, the repack business. But you know, as long as there's transparency, people know what knows what's been hit and what hasn't. You know, I'm with you guys. Like, I don't see anything wrong with it. It's kind of like breaking too, right? You have bad breakers, shady breakers. You kind of have shady repackers now. And once things get cleaned up, as the hobby continues to grow, as the industry continues to grow, then I think no one's going to really talk about whether repack is good for the hobby or not. I think people are just going to accept it as a regular, different part of the business or part of the hobby, right? So yeah, I commend C-Bless for bringing this discussion. I didn't know it was going to take off and everyone's going to talk about it, but it is a good discussion to have. And if there's any new development on the repack front, we'll definitely dedicate a bigger portion of a future episode on the issue. All right, with that, let's play our interview with our friend Roy. Today we have another special guest with us. As we mentioned at the top of the show, he's a good friend of ours, and he's the guy we go to for any Pokemon card questions we might have. His name is Roy, and I was just at the Sports Card Expo with him in Toronto recently, and I wanted to pick up a nice Charizard for my son, and he helped me pick out a cool card. He gave me the backstory on it and even, you know, potential investment value, which was greatly appreciated because I could have totally been ripped off if I just picked one by myself, right? So since that show, I've been doing a ton more research and I've gone down the rabbit hole. And now my son and I talk about Pokemon cards all the time. But there's so much more to learn, I know. So without further ado, Roy, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's a long time coming, right? We've always wanted Roy to come on, and finally he has agreed to talk Pokemon. So I'm looking forward to this chat. All right, let's start with how you got into Pokemon. Did you collect as a kid, and what got you back into Pokemon cards?
Yeah, like I started collecting back in 1999 when the set first came out.
Okay.
You know, my parents had a store, so. Every now and then I'll just take it back and rip it open. So then I start collecting, you know, I collect with my friends. We start playing the card game. But, you know, that's how I first got into it. I fell in love with the game and, you know, everything after, you know, the TV show, the Game Boy game. And then, I didn't take care of my cards, which I truly regret. I wasn't diligent like John, putting them into, you know, sleeves and binders right away. I would just hold it by the stack and just shove it in my pocket, go to school, go to church, and just play the game with my friends, show off the cards. So that's one thing I do regret about collecting as a kid. But how I got back into it is pretty much, you know, a little bit because of Hyung and John. They, during COVID or like right before COVID, they got me into sports cards, you know. I just started buying everything, you know. I was buying rookie cards, all base chrome. Apparently that was a go-to thing. So then I started getting hooked on sports cards. Just that was nostalgic too, you know, collecting sports cards as a kid, hockey cards, baseball cards. And then
for sure.
And then a few months into it, you know, I was a part of this Discord group, and someone posted this one picture of this Pokemon card, and I was like, whoa, what's that? it was like a full art card. And, you know, back when I was collecting, I only collected for like probably about like 1 or 2 years. So it was like base set fossil, like intro sets, like the very first cards, the iterations of the Pokemon cards. And then I see this card that has like the whole length of the card is like a full image. And then, you know, it's so nostalgic to me. It was like Pikachu, Bulbasaur, Charmander, and Squirtle all on that one card. And I was like, man, that card is sick. I want that. I need that.
Yeah.
So then I started, you know, looking into like, what card is that? How do I get it? You know, lo and behold, that card was like a $5,000 Japanese Pokemon card. But I was like, okay, what else can I get into into buying Pokemon cards? So I started, you know, slowly crawling into that rabbit hole, looking for deals, you know, because all the sports cards I was buying like $100-$300 sports cards. And I, you know, I was like, okay, I could do the same thing with Pokemon. But that's when like the sports card, it was kind of going downhill. Like that base game, everyone started to jump on, you know, numbered cards or something a little bit more than base. So I was like, okay, you know what? I'll just do the same thing with Pokemon and see where that takes me. That's how I kind of got back into the whole collecting Pokemon. It was through John, through John and Hyung and collecting sports cards that transitioned into Pokemon. And I wouldn't say thanks to John and Hyung because they made me lose a lot of money on sports cards.
Who are you listening to? Bought at the peak. Getting base.
Got at the peak and
sold at the low. Yeah, that will kill you.
I got back into Pokemon, and you know, I've been doing pretty well with that, so I'm happy.
I was going to say, I feel like you at least broke even. You know, you got all the profits from Pokemon.
Yeah, it's the skill sets you learn, Roy.
Come on. I agree.
Big picture, Roy. Big picture.
I just wish I got into it maybe 1 or 2 years later, and then I would have been gravy.
Yeah, same. All right, we all say that about sports cards too. Yeah. or at least in 2021, 2020, we wish we went heavy into a lot of the more rare cards. But that's why we wanted you on too, because I know, you know, like in our friend WhatsApp chat group, that where we talk about sports cards mainly. You know, lately we're talking about how we're just losing money and how our Lewis Robert collection is useless. And you know, how we're trying to sell junk slabs. And then meanwhile, every once in a while, Roy would message like, oh man, this Pokemon card I have just 3x.
Yeah.
And we're like, what? Yeah. So we're like, we need to learn more about Pokemon cards. So that's why, you know, some of these questions for more seasoned Pokemon card collectors might think they're very basic because they are. But for sports card collectors, this might be new to them. So I hope this is of value. This episode is of value. And I'm going to start from the beginning. You know, when we talk about Pokemon cards and other TCG cards in general, the first edition cards are always highly coveted, of course, right? So can you tell us about Pokemon first edition cards, you know, when they were released and which ones are going for big bucks right now? I know you just mentioned 1999. Would they be the ones considered first edition cards?
Yeah, and before I continue, I want to full disclosure. I am no Pokemon expert. I am not a pro. I just do it as a hobby. And, you know, this is the information that I currently know, but I'll try to pass on as much knowledge as I can.
Okay, appreciate it.
But in terms of first edition, 1999, they had their first print first edition cards, base. And the ones that you want to go for are anything that's holographic. Those are the ones that will hold the most value, especially if they grade well. You know, the card being 25 years old, if you didn't grade it right away, you didn't pack sleeve it, it's not going to be in good shape because, you know, most of the kids played it as a TCG. So, you know, whether you put it in sleeves or not, it's still being played. So there's a lot more wear and tear, more scratches or whatever it is. So the conditions are harder to find. But yeah, in terms of what you want to be collecting, the holographics and any like the, you know, Charizards, obviously the go-to, any of the OG starters, Blastoise, Venusaur, Mewtwo. There's a few that you want to be collecting, and it's definitely the 1999 set. But in Japan, actually, the Japanese version, their cards came out in 1996. So it took about 3 years for them to
interesting
that hype to develop and then transition or, you know, come over to the North American side.
And when you said you had a store and you just ripped open packs, were those the first edition sets that you're talking about?
No, definitely not. I think first edition would only be like card stores because, you know, they're just getting whatever. You know, convenience stores are always lagged. You know, our immigrant parents are like, oh, you're making money on this? Okay, I'm going to go buy these Pokemon cards and sell them at our store too. So definitely wasn't first edition, but they were base cards, 1999 base. So I was lucky to have those.
You mentioned Charizard, I know there's a bunch of characters, but just out of curiosity, were those characters like popular from the get? You know what I mean? Like Charizard, Pikachu, or did they gain popularity over time?
I think in like the US or North American side, Charizard was always kind of like the go-to. He was always considered like the chase card, the one to get.
Right, okay.
You know, it's so hard thinking back. Like, I was just happy to get any holo, you know? Back then I didn't really have a favorite Pokemon that I really grew attached to at the time when I was collecting cards. It was just fun to play, you know, you just play the game, you try to beat your friends and then, you know, show off your collection.
Before we start recording, you know, we mentioned how like you're younger than us, Roy, so you actually played with them. And you know, when the 1999, I was like in my early 20s. I totally missed the point. Totally missed the boat on Pokemon. It was, you know, way behind me. But John, were you part of that?
At least 99, I just graduated high school. But my younger brother, he collected, I remember. So I do, watching him collect, I do recall Charizard being popular back then. I remember he was a bit of a chase. Mm. And Pikachu was obviously popular because everyone only knew of Pokemon because of the show. And obviously he's sort of the main character in the show, right? So
interesting. Yeah. Okay. You mentioned earlier too, like, Japan came out with the 1996 set. So other than the language on the cards themselves, are there any other main differences between the Japanese and the US or the English sets? And which one do you personally like better?
Yeah, there could be a totally different array of cards in terms of Japanese and English. Like most of the sets are the same, but I didn't collect from like 2001 till like 2020. So there's a big gap of cards I don't really have knowledge on. But like what I'm seeing, you know, by looking and doing some research, there's some cards that are part of a set in the Japanese sets, and they're not part of the set in terms of like ripping. They have the same cards, but you know, some of them are in packs in the Japanese sets, and some of them come as promotional cards. So if you buy like a booster box or like an ETB, it'll come as a free card. So everyone that buys that ETB will get this free promo card, whereas in the Japanese card, it'll be a card that you pull. So there's different variants of that. There's other promotional cards. Like if you buy from Best Buy $20, you get like a Best Buy inscripted card. And there's all these different promotionals that like the Japanese have and the English sets have, or vice versa. Like one's in the set and one's not. Sorry, what was the other question?
Just the main differences. So which one do you personally like to collect?
Yeah, so I started collecting English when I first got into it, but then slowly started rolling over onto the Japanese side. And that's mainly because the quality control on the Japanese is so much higher than the ones on the English sets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So like if you were to grade, like let's say 100 cards that are English, like random, you just pull them in the packs, you collect 100 cards, English, 100 cards, Japanese, you're probably going to get gem rate like 80% PSA 10 on the Japanese cards, whereas the English, you'll probably get like 20%.
Oh, wow. Oof.
Yeah. And I think,
wouldn't that make it more rare? Or is it that doesn't really matter? It's just more options.
Yeah. Like I guess, you know, you just have to pick and choose which ones you're going to be sending to PSA. If you're looking at the English, you'll really inspect the card. Whereas Japanese, you just have to like flip it back and forth. You're like, this one's good, and send it in. For the most part, you know, I'm generalizing, especially these.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the grading or the conditions have to do with, you know, they use different card stocks for one. Like the Japanese card stock is a lot thinner than the ones that are English. And I think Japanese laser cuts their cards, whereas the English sets, they use like the blade, or they just, you know, the knife to cut the cards.
Oh, wow.
Don't quote me on that. That's what I heard.
Yeah, and that's interesting though.
And like, there's just way less print runs in the Japanese sets than there are in the English, because Pokemon Japan, they don't really care about the demand that's outside of Japan. They only care about the citizens of Japan, and they print for that type of, for their population. Hmm. Whereas like now more and more people are, you know, jumping on the Japanese train for collecting Pokemon cards, but
right,
they're not really printing more. They're just keeping it. If the demand's high in Japan, they'll print for Japanese population, but they don't really care.
Yeah.
So like right away when a set comes out, you know, a booster box retails for like $50 in Japan. It's automatically, no matter like if you know the card list or not, it's going to be $100 minimum, like resale. Mm. And then whether the set is good or bad, that's when it goes up even higher or goes down further.
Interesting. Initially what Hyun was asking, I was thinking the same thing. If the gem rate is so much higher with the Japanese cards, I would have expected it to be, you know, the same card from the Japanese set compared to the English card. I thought it would be not as expensive as the English version because the, you know, there's an 80% gem rate. But I guess what you're saying is that the print run is a main factor in determining supply and demand.
Yeah, I think,
is that what I'm?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like the there's definitely, if you have two of the same cards, Japanese set is typically more expensive for especially for the rare cards.
Right,
but that's not always the case. But I would say generally, Japanese cards, they'll have a lower pop rate and they'll have a more expensive price for the card.
Yeah. You know, since I've been doing more research on Pokemon cards, like I guess one of the things I expect to happen is as more people get into collecting Pokemon cards because of the internet, because of eBay, Facebook groups, like you can have better access to Japanese cards than before, right? So maybe the demand is going to be higher for a Japanese set that has a lower print run, which could be, I guess, if you're an investor type, that might be the better play, do you think?
Yeah, so like buying, I think the good play is like buying booster boxes. I only started collecting not like for the past few years, so I've only had access to whatever sets came out. But yeah, buying, like if you buy a booster box, typically if the set is good, it'll do really well. So in like 2020, I bought a booster box of this set called Dream League. I was buying them for $80 each. And then at the peak, they were selling for like almost $2,000 a box.
Holy.
Whoa, wow. Yeah.
Now they're probably around $900. But yeah,
still, like, wow.
There was just a bull run of like Japanese people wanting. And it was like the Japanese card stores were putting out bounties on like every single card, any set. They'll say if market rate was like $1,000 for a box, they'll just say, okay, anyone that brings their box to us will buy it for $1,100. So they're paying above market. So who's not going to go to these stores? So then that's what causes huge bull run in like, I think it was like May of 2023. So this year.
Oh, wow. That's recent.
But yeah, everything has come down a lot. Not back to normal, but came down a lot because that bull run was like absolutely crazy. I had a card that was worth $2,000 at the time, and then it jumped up 10x to $20,000. You know, to diamond hands I didn't sell, and now it's it's back down to like $3,000. So, you know,
that's right. I remember when Roy put that in our chat, and then I believe all of us said, "Roy, you got to sell."
Yeah.
We were like, "Sell quickly!" And of course, he didn't. But which card was that?
It was a Japanese card. It's called Alola Friends, and in PSA 10. So that's like PSA a special, 10. You know, special set. They sell these boxes. There's only two cards inside of the box. That's it, and the rest are kind of like accessories. I think it's called like Master Collection. So then it was a really rare card. The only way to get it is buying this box, and there's only two cards inside. So everyone got the same two promotional cards. So then I was like, okay, you know, that's kind of rare, so I'll give it a shot. I'll buy it. I like the image on it.
Mm.
And then you know, I did really well. But at the end of the day, I'm almost back to to even ground.
Yeah, well, this, holy smokes, like just the two cards in a box kind of reminds me of like National Treasures Panini Flawless, like super high end, I guess. And I think you know, when we were talking at the card show, I was trying to draw different parallels from the sports card market to the Pokemon card markets, mm-hmm. so I could better understand what Pokemon cards are all about. So in that vein, are there any other parallels, you know, in terms of, pardon the pun with parallels, but like you mentioned holos, I guess that's kind of like the equivalent of a sports card parallel, or, you know, a reverse holo, like different kind of variations of the card.
I wouldn't say those are the parallels, but, yeah, I guess it would be, because there would be the regular and then there'll be the holo version for some of the cards. But I would say, you know, it's hard to, because it's a trading card game. You can't have parallels. You can't have number cards.
True.
Because everyone needs the card to play the game, right?
Right. Makes sense.
The only thing I would consider like a numbered card is like a world championship card. So the people that are playing the actual TCG game at the world championships, if they rank like winner, second place, top eight, top 16, top 32, they get this card.
Right.
This card that's only given out to those contestants, and they're stamped how well they did. So you know, some of those contestants will just sell the card because they don't care about it, or they just want money. And then it's now become a collector's item. So like, I don't think anyone's really selling them off as they were easily back then. So I would say those are probably the numbered cards. Those have been, you know, becoming more popular these days.
Great.
And you know, some of them are fetching like a really pretty penny, like, I think it was like the 1998 one that I was talking to you about, Clark, off the show.
Yeah.
Like those cards are like $100,000 cards. And it doesn't even have to be a PSA 10. Like a PSA 8 will go for like $100,000. So.
Right. Because it's so rare.
Exactly.
Yeah, makes sense. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. I'm just trying to wrap my head around some of the different Pokemon characters that are, you know, from the different sets. My son has a different one every week.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what? I never heard of that one and things like that. So who would you say are the MJ and LeBron of Pokemon? You know, like who are the GOATs in the Pokemon? Maybe we already mentioned with Charizard, but are there any other ones that are like elite level status?
That's the beauty about Pokemon. Like whoever collects, like you're truly collecting what you love. Because you either fall in love with the Pokemon from either playing the game, you enjoyed the character, or you could like relate with them. Like when I talk to my kids, I'm Snorlax because like I just want to sleep.
Right.
That's not my favorite Pokemon, but you know, for someone it can be.
Sure.
But like, yeah, the main Pokemons, I think the popular ones are like definitely Charizard, any like the OG starters, Blastoise, Venusaur, Mewtwo's definitely big, Gengar. Eevee and like the evolution, so Eevee can turn into like eight different evolutions, and the top one from those, like all of them are probably pretty popular, but the most popular from that is probably this one called Umbreon.
Yeah, is that the black one?
Yeah exactly.
Let's see, all right, I'm learning.
You're doing
this
well.
Might be a dumb this might be a dumb question though, but are there any new characters introduced in Pokemon, and you know, if there are, do those cards hold any value? Right, I guess the equivalent in the sports card world is like new rookies coming up that sports card collectors of course love to chase. Are there something like that in the Pokemon world?
Yeah, they're not as loved as the rookie cards in the sports card world, but every generation, so like the show will go on, and then after that season is done, there's a generation, there's a second generation. So after generation one, there's generation two. And in that generation, they throw out like another 100, 200 Pokemon to introduce. But every first show, there's three starters again. So, you know, our era was Charmander, Bulbasaur, Squirtle. The next one was like, I don't know, it's pretty embarrassing. I actually don't know. But like the newest generation just came out like, I think it was like a few months ago. So there's another three starters. I think it's like Sprigatito, Fuego, Go, and some other one. So there's always those three. There's always going to be three starters.
Right. Okay. How many generations are there now?
I have no idea.
A lot.
I think it's a lot. Seven or something.
Oh, okay.
No idea. Don't call me.
we'll do research after the show. Yeah, exactly. No. Okay. But no, yeah, I didn't know about the three starters. And there's always three per generation.
Yeah, there's always three, and then there's always Pikachu. So Pikachu's always the main Pokemon.
Yeah.
And then there's always three starters for the other guys to pick from.
Yeah. Okay. You know, when I first heard about Pokemon, and obviously I heard about Pikachu first because it's the main character. Like, I always assumed Pikachu was the most powerful, right? Because it's the most popular. And then my son's like, "Oh, I don't like Pikachu because it's so weak." I'm like, "Why is Pikachu like the main Pokemon in these series if it's not the strongest?" Like, I didn't get it, but it's still beloved by many, I hear.
I'm mainly a Pikachu collector. Like, that's pretty much all I collect. I had that memory of Pikachu being, you know,
right.
A free spirit. So it would be because you like the character, like you like that's why someone would, I guess, collect, or it would have collectability, is because they would just like the character, for instance.
Yeah. So like collectability for Pokemon is like, you know, if you pick like the popular ones, right, they'll always have at least one like really expensive card. But yeah, for myself, like, yeah, I just like Pikachu. I thought it was cute. It never went inside a Pokeball, and it just kind of, you know, walked around saying Pika Pika to Ash. So I was like, oh, that's cute. You know, I was like 10 years older.
See,
you know,
to me, this is cool. All like hobby. This all falls under hobby logic.
Right.
Well, he's the main character, like one of the main characters. So
yeah, he's iconic, yeah. And I feel like he's also featured. He's also featured in a lot of rare cards and stuff like special cards or special promotional cards. It's usually Pikachu there, right? So
yeah. For the most part, it'll always be Pikachu because that's what Pokemon is kind of pushing as the main. And they know everyone loves Pikachu, so.
Pikachu's cute. How can you not love Pikachu?
Exactly.
You know, next I want to ask you about some of the terminology used by Pokemon collectors that I think might be useful for those who want to get into it. So I'll list a few that I've come across, like, even just on like eBay listings. I'm like, I don't understand what this means. So until I had to dig and do research. So we talked about reverse holo, reverse foil, which was a concept that I wasn't aware of. Like, obviously we know about holo and things like that, but the reverse holo is when, I guess, in Pokemon cards, there's a box and a picture of the character in the box, but the reverse holo is when the background of the card is holographic, I guess, and the picture itself isn't.
Yeah, exactly. So typically it would just be the background where the words are, you know, the borders.
Right.
That's the holographic part, and the actual photo of the Pokemon is non-holographic.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much. It's just like the reverse holographics, right? So that would be the parallel. That would be like your pink, you know, in baseball or something like that.
Cool. Typically what's more valuable, the holo or the reverse holo?
They're both pretty not much worth not much.
Okay.
Depending on the set. Some of the older sets, their reverse holos are worth a lot. And like with the new set called 151, which is like the original 151 Pokemon, in the Japanese they have like, it's like a reverse holo, but it's called the Master Ball. So those ones are fetching a lot of money. So it really varies on set. But for the most part, reverse holos aren't worth, you know, anything more.
Gotcha. Yeah. So they're kind of like pink refractors and green refractors.
Yeah. Greens are numbered, though, right?
Greens are numbered,
So. Oh, you know what? For I'm thinking prism, basketball. So green prisms are.
Prism.
Yes, right. Okay. Non-numbered pink and green refractors. I remember when we were walking around in the expo, and then there was a note that says LP. Do you want to tell them what LP stands for?
Yeah, so as you know, like Pokemon is a trading card game. So when you buy a raw card, they have all these different acronyms for the condition of the card. So there's like LP, sorry, there's like damaged, which is DMG, you'll see. HP, which is heavily played. MP, moderately played. LP, lightly played. NM, near mint. And then like some people just coin mint, like, or like near mint to mint. And this is the condition of the card. But the thing is, like, everyone has a different understanding of what these conditions are. You know, when you're selling a card, you know, your near mint is different than someone who's buying a card because they expect it to be near, like, perfect. But, you know, yeah. if you're trying to buy a card and it says near mint, like, there's still going to be the chance to have, like, damaged edges or, you know, whitening on the card. Right. So don't expect every near mint to be, you know, a gem mint 10 if you're going to submit it to grade. In that stipulation of near mint is, you know, potential damage, small scratches, tiny little, you know, blemishes,
imperfections.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. And yeah. As you go down that list, you know, obviously the wear and tear of the card is greater, right?
Yeah. So that's quite similar to the sports card world, right? Like, I never expect near mints to be mint. I always expect the worst. So you know what you're getting yourself into. A couple more. The next ones are like V, like on the cards themselves, V, V-Star, EX, GX. Any of those have any special meaning, or is it just labels for the cards?
I think I don't play the trading card game and I don't watch the show.
Oh, okay.
So from what I know, like V is like, you know, after they evolve, they could get into a better, bigger form or something. I know like VMAX is like, they become like these huge versions of themselves or like something like that.
Right.
But I don't know too much in terms of like what they are, what they mean or what they look like.
No, that's fair. All right, we talked about first edition sets at the beginning of the interview. Are there any other popular sets, you know, that seem to be holding their value or even increasing in value? Like, you know, I know you didn't collect yourself from 2001 to there's a big gap there, but just when you look for certain cards, like, are there any iconic type sets that seem to be popping up where, oh, these cards are always priced really well because everyone wants them?
Yeah, like definitely vintage sets, like certain vintage sets, like everyone loves like the Neo Genesis or Crystal. But like in terms of like the more modern cards, like the 151 that just came out recently, I think that's like a great set to buy and hold long term. But yeah, like honestly, like the new sets that have been coming out for the Scarlet and Violet series. Mm-hmm. Nah, it ain't it, man. Like, there hasn't been too many good sets recently. So all those, you know, if you're looking just to rip for cheap, those are good sets to rip. Like, you know, long term, they may go up in value, but in terms of, yeah, I wouldn't be collecting those or looking at those. I'd be looking at, you know, the series before some Sword and Shield or even Sun and Moon. Those are some good eras to be collecting in. But if you want something more modern, I think 151 is a good hold, especially on the Japanese sets because they have that exclusive Master Ball reverse hole that the English sets don't have. So,
cool. Yeah, and 151, that's the one with Snorlax on the box?
It's Mew.
Or Mew.
Yeah.
Right, okay, gotcha. Okay, you know, last question that I have until we do a kind of our usual rapid fire at the end. And you know, I'll throw it to John and Hyung if they have any more questions. But, you know, we're fast approaching Christmas, and I'm sure a lot of kids are going to get some Pokemon cards as gifts. But if you do go to Walmart or to a hobby shop, you'll realize there are so many different set configurations out there, right? Like to buy, you could get tins, you could get, you mentioned ETB for people that don't know. It's Elite Trainer Boxes and then Booster Packs, Booster Boxes, of course, all available at different price points. So, you know, for me, it reminds me of in the sports car world, like hobby boxes, jumbo boxers, blasters, hanger packs, all those things. So, is there a configuration you would say would give you the most bang for your buck? Like, usually I think of hobby boxes, you know, you're guaranteed an autograph or two. Are there ones that you just, you know, if you're looking for a hit, what's the one product that you would buy?
Yeah, so the thing about a hobby box, similar to sports cards, you can't buy hobby boxes in, you know, retail. So there's something called a booster box, at least on the English side, that is guaranteed your hits. I think you're guaranteed like one hit. So that's like you're guaranteed, but you have to buy those at like a, you know, either on the Pokemon website when it drops or through like your local card store. But in terms of like if you're going into a Walmart, ETBs are fun, but then you're paying for a lot of like accessories. for like dice and all these like coins that come inside. It's, sometimes they come with a promo card if they're a special set. They're priced a little higher in terms of price per pack, but they're also the ones that will do better long term if you're going to buy and hold.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you just have to buy what's in your budget. You know, you buy if you could afford, you know, three packs, three sleeve boosters, do that. Or if you want a tin, but in terms of best bang for buck, yeah, like tins are fun. You know, but you only get a couple packs. You got to know what's inside. Like they don't explicitly say which sets are inside the tins. So you kind of have to do like research before.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it'll just say like sword and shield, like two packs, and then you have to like kind of guess, or you just do some research beforehand, like what packs come in these tins. But yeah, like if you're going to Walmart, ETBs are always good, but they're overpriced just because like Walmart's just gouging everybody. Sports cards too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like right. Back in the day, you buy blister for like $30. Now it's what are they now? 60, 50?
Yeah, 40, 45, yeah, for sure. Brutal. Okay. Hyung John, you have any questions?
I have a question. Like, go ahead. I don't think I would get into Pokemon too much, but I do know all my like friends' kids love Pokemon, and sometimes I'm like, this would be a great gift or whatever. If I had like $100 budget, would it be better to buy like a single that can appreciate in the future, like a graded single, or would it be better to buy just like a box or whatever?
Yeah, like it's tough to say. It's like sports cards. It's better to buy the single than to try to rip and get the chase, right? Mm-hmm. But that's part of the fun too. And that's why I love ripping with my kid, like, because he could rip, as long as it's a full art card, he could rip a 1 cent full art card, but he's so pumped. He's like, yeah, full art. And you see this joy in your face, like, whereas like, you know, for us, you know, a little bit older grown ups or even like, you know, teenagers, they're just going for that chase card. If they don't hit the chase, they're like, that was garbage. But you know, when you're ripping with kids, like, they just have so much joy ripping, and you know, that's what I love about the hobby. You just get to see this overwhelming joy when they hit a card. Same with sports card, right? When you see these kids rip cards, you're like, they get so pumped, and that's what I love. So
that's cool. Yeah.
But yeah, if you were to gift, you have $100 budget. Yeah, buy a single. If they say like, this is the card I want, yeah, buy the single. If you want to have fun with them, just buy a, you know, ETB and rip like 8 packs with them. Or that's what I would say.
When Hyung mentioned, you know, whether it's better to get slapped, Pokemon card, is there a grading company that's preferred in the Pokemon card world? Is it kind of like sports cards where PSA is still king and everything else is below PSA? Like, what's the hierarchy, would you say?
That's exactly what I was going
to
ask.
Yeah, it's all the same. CGC, okay. There used to be a big fan base for CGC, but ever since they changed their slabs, like everyone's dogging them, so...
Interesting.
Ever since they went from like 9.5,
I like the new slabs.
Yeah, but everything that was a 9.5 automatically got bumped up to a 10, right? It kind of like messed with the whole like pricing. So at first, I think there's like a big bump, like, oh, it's a 10. The prices went high, but then after everyone realized, like, what is a 10? What is a 9.5? Like, there's no real like true understanding of what the card actually is graded.
Yeah.
That's when their price started to go down. So PSA, I think, is still king. Black Label, which I think there's a lot more Black Labels in Pokemon than there are in sports cards. So a lot of people chase that, you know, that Black Label, try to get that Black Label, because especially with Japanese, I don't think the gem rate's high in terms of getting the Black Label, but much higher than any other cards out there, I would say. Yeah. So again, like sports card, Black Label's number one, PSA 10, and then down the list.
Very similar. Yeah.
So we're in like the four of us are in a friends chat group for the listeners. And Roy has been one of the only ones that are still actively grading.
Oh, yeah.
And he blesses us with PSA reveals on our chat group, which is amazing. So Roy now, you know, you got like sort of this experience of grading sports cards and Pokemon cards. The way you look and inspect the Pokemon card are there nuances about Pokemon cards that you need to be aware of when you're grading them? Or is it like exactly the same? You know, like you look for a whitening, you look, obviously centering, whitening surfaces is pretty much a mainstay. But is there anything different about Pokemon in the way you have to look at the card versus a sports card?
Not necessarily, but the borders are very clear, which helps, you know, your eye align the card, saying, is this card centered or not? They have like silver borders or yellow borders. So it's a lot easier to say, okay, this is 60-40. Is this could have a potential of 9, or sorry, a potential of a 10, or it might be a 9. So you have a better understanding of what's well centered. Pokemon cards do have some print lines. If they're older cards, they have scratches. Anything that has like whitening, I typically won't send in on the back of the card or on the edges, unless it's like a little bit of an older card and PSA 9 still hold a really good value. Then I'll still send those in. Right. Expect a 9, and if I get a 10, bonus. If not, then you know I'll keep it as a 9 or sell it or trade or whatever. But yeah, pretty much you're looking for the same things: scratches, whitening, centering.
Yeah.
There's just nothing you could really do in terms of like cleaning the surface of a Pokemon card, because it's like, you know, it's not chrome, right? It's just paper. It's cardstock.
Right. But Roy does a good job because, like, whenever he does his reveal, it's like a 90% gem rate.
Yeah, all he's is 10 PSA 10s.
Yeah, like, again, like, because I do like 99% Japanese cards, like, they're so easy to come back as a gem, like, and it's so easy to see which ones aren't going to be coming back a gem, right? So,
Good to know.
Yeah, like, yeah, I had binders of like cards, and I'll be like, oh, this is worth something now. So then I'll just take them all out, look at them. And I just submitted them all, and they all come back 10. So quality control for Japanese Pokemon cards is really good.
All right. I'm just, after this podcast, I'm just going to look for Japanese Pokemon cards to buy raw and then submit them for grading.
And the best part is, like, Pokemon, like, grading Pokemon costs is way more cheap than grading sports cards. Why? I don't know. Like, PSA, I think it's $15 a card, or they had a promotion for $15 a card USD trading card, whereas sports is, well, I don't know, what did they charge sports, like $24 or something?
It's ridiculous.
About 30 now, though, right?
Including upcharge, 30? Like, oh man.
Oh, that upcharge.
Yeah. Did he do upcharge for Pokemon cards?
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, oh yeah. So like the last submission, I got upcharged for like 7 of the cards. But like when I was submitting last year, when Pokemon wasn't as popular or the Japanese market, I was sending like $1,000 cards raw, or like $500 cards raw, they come back at 10 and there'd be no upcharge. I'd be like, oh, maybe they just don't know. Because I got 0 upcharges in the last like 2 or 3 submissions. I've always got upcharged at least for like 1 or 2 cards. So
There you go. It's getting more popular.
Yeah. They're
understanding. I think that's just a matter of time till TCG cards are going to be like $30 to grade, just like sports cards.
No, thank you.
So it's a matter of time.
Yeah.
Well, Roy, thanks for, you know, enlightening us. And I certainly learned a lot. I looked at the time and it's like, wow, 40 minutes already just talking Pokemon cards. I would have never thought this would happen on this pod. But appreciate it. I know you're a loyal listener to our podcast as well. So you know that we like to do rapid fire at the end of every interview for our guests. So first one, which Pokemon card is your favorite that you own right now?
Yeah, it's going back to that same picture that got me back into Pokemon. It's the Pikachu Festa 2016, the 20th anniversary. Yeah. Has Pikachu in the middle. It's got the 3 OG starters. There's only 2 cards in all of Pokemon that have the OG starters all in one card with Pikachu. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them. And the other one is a half art. So that's definitely the one that has my heart.
Amazing.
That's a cool card. I was like, oh, damn, I want one too. And then I see that's like $10,000. I'm like, okay, I'm not getting that one. But, I have to work up to it. What's your Grail Pokemon card that you hope to have one day?
Grail Pokemon card? Probably. It's hard to say. There's just so much. Because the knowledge, I don't have the full knowledge. But so every time I'm like going into a deep dive, like, oh, I want to spend this much, or like I want to set like a list of what cards I want, I'm like, oh, what is that? And you know, and then there's a story behind it. But right now, I guess my next Grail would be Mysterious Mountains Charizard PSA 10, which is like the crystal version of the English set. I don't know, it just looks so cool. I love that whole era of, you know, the Sky Ridge. So that would probably be my next Grail card on the list.
Nice, nice. How much is it going for these days?
I think it's like, I forget, it was like 11,000 or 15,000 USD.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. Damn.
Wow. All right. I think I know this answer already because we talked about grading, but would you rather have a PSA 9 or a CGC 10?
Oh, easily PSA 9.
Really?
Whoa.
Well, okay. Honestly, it really depends. Like, there's so much variation in Pokemon, like being rare, being vintage, being like, you know, ones that are like, and some people, a lot of people grade with CGC. There's a lot of love. There used to be. I don't think as much anymore, but a lot of people still submit to CGC. I guess maybe because they're like, I don't think it's going to get a PSA 10, so let's try for a CGC 10. I don't know if that's the logic or not, but for the most part, I'd probably rather have a PSA 9.
Okay. So Roy's also part of the PSA snob club.
Yeah, 100%.
So just
it's the one that has the most value. It's the one that everybody knows, everyone trusts.
Yeah. Hyung's the president of that club, and Roy is vice president. Yeah. If you ever want to come to BGS, that's where I'm at. Okay. Which Pokemon is cuter, Charmander or Squirtle? And which one's more popular, do you think?
I think probably Charmander is more popular. I like Squirtle better. I don't know. I was never a huge Charizard guy. I did buy the red version instead of the blue for the Game Boy. But after playing, I was like, oh, Charizard Blaster is pretty cool. Charizard, you know, everyone just loves Charizard, and I don't know why.
Because it's cool. The dragon, it's awesome. And last one is, what would you say is the most underrated Pokemon card or set? Whatever comes to mind.
Oh, that's so hard. Underrated set or underrated Pokemon?
Yeah.
There's over 1,000 Pokemon, so who can be underrated? Like,
is there over 1,000?
Wow, yeah, there's great. Over 1,000 now.
I guess with all the generations, yeah. Or how about which Pokemon do you think deserves more hobby love? We talk about this in the sports card world, which athlete, like Dame Lillard and, you know, other athletes. But which Pokemon card do you think, or which Pokemon do you think deserves a little bit more love that probably doesn't get enough?
It's got to be Squirtle, no?
No, it's probably
going to be Squirtle gets you a lot.
Like Blastoise? Like, I always thought he should be like near the same level and value as Charizard, but I feel like it's not even close.
Yeah, I don't think
in terms of value. Like, he's still quote unquote popular, but not in terms of value.
Yeah, they're like fractions of what Charizards are worth, like the top end Charizards versus the top end Blastoise. Like, doesn't even compare. Like, one is like unattainable, and one's like, maybe I could afford that, you know? But yeah, like something that's underrated, I don't know, something maybe like someone like Lucario. Probably don't know who these guys are. I barely know them. I only know this. My kid starts watching the show, and sometimes I watch them. Oh, that's pretty cool, Pokemon. But yeah, I think like someone
complete blank stare from Hyung and I.
Yeah, you're like, who?
Like, no
I'm
idea.
I'm just trying to put all this together. I'm trying to get the parallels to the sports card industry. I'm just... I'm just an observer right now.
Okay, interesting. My son wants a Latias. I don't know if that's how you say it.
Yeah, Latias. But,
I love.
I don't know. If I'm saying it right. We're in the same boat, Clark.
But
we're just dads of Pokemon kids.
I love it because I look at the card. I'm like, oh, PSA 10 is worth $40. Perfect. Oh, okay. You know, he doesn't like the expensive ones. So,
nice.
So I'll get that for him for Christmas. All right, Roy, thanks so much for, you know, talking Pokemon with us. And you know what? We haven't done this with a guest, but he's going to stay on for our next weekly segment we call Pick One. All right. So this will be fun because I think this is a first, right? On our Pokemon history, on our podcast history, where we got a special guest coming in to this next, you know, weekly segment that we do all the time. So Roy, do you actually have one to lead off with since you're our special guest?
Yeah, I'll think of one on the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah. So would you guys rather have one $10,000 Pokemon card that you cannot trade, you cannot sell, it's part of your collection, any $10,000 Pokemon card, or would you rather have a $2,000 sports card of your favorite player, rookie card, or whatever it is.
$2,000?
Yeah. So like one fifth of the cost. But one is worth $10,000 and it can increase, but you're not allowed to trade it. You're not, it's like in your PC for forever. Or would you rather have
it? You can't sell it.
You can't sell it. You can't do nothing. You can't. It's just in your collection. But it's $10,000 and it's growing. Or like it's going to steadily grow. Or would you rather have a $2,000 sports card of your choice and you could do whatever you want with it?
Okay.
Because I know you guys don't like Pokemon, but like, are you seeing value? Like, or, you know, even if it's like a $50,000 card and then you have like a $5,000 sports card, would you rather have some type of grail that cannot be traded, sold, or would you rather have a sports card that you can kind of, you know,
I'll go first on that.
Yeah, I think you gotta see it as like a sports contract. You know, in the future, that trade clause is going to be lifted, and you're gonna be allowed to deal with it.
Yeah. No, there's a way around it in the future. I know. So I like rarity. I like things that, you know, people have. There's a lot of demand for, and I think I would go with the Pokemon card to keep in my collection for sure. Yeah, like for me, it's like sports cards is not everything. Like I have rare memorabilia too. So it's like, I just like cool, rare stuff. And it, you know, it starts conversations and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm going to go with the 5X value of a Pokemon. Yeah. You know, I'm going to do it one day. Watch. I'm going to actually do it. Like a super high end Pokemon. Like do one of those like,
nice.
Those, yeah. Super, super rare.
I believe it. John.
I feel like we're about to be all on the same page.
Oh.
Roydo's, like, I'm a Pokemon fan from afar. I know nothing about it, but the art, like, the full art looks amazing. He gifted me with, like, a small card with, the three latest generation starters, which I appreciate. And when I look at Roy's collection, that card that he talked about that is like 10 grand or whatever, the Pikachu with the three OG starters, like the artwork on that one is like amazing. And it just brings back a lot of memories, like watching my brother. And I mean, even as us older guys, we still remember Pokemon, as whether we collected it or not, saw the video games and all of that stuff. So I think the art itself is cool. The collectability is really cool. And clearly I think Pokemon is a TCG that is probably on the sports card level, where it's sticking around for the long haul. It's not going anywhere. It continues to appeal generation after generation. So even long-term investment wise, it feels like a no-brainer. So yeah, give me that $10,000 Pokemon card.
Okay. It's going to be a 10K sweep. I'm going with the Pokemon too. You know, like, you know, I especially since I've been, you know, researching more about Pokemon, like I definitely appreciate it more as art as well, right? So, you know, something that gains value, something that I could hand down to my son and he can, you know, if he can't sell it, it could be one of those things that it just gets handed down. I like the idea of that as well. And I like flexing every once in a while. If it's a card that just continues to gain, I'd love to show people. Just put it on the mantle and you know, show it off to anyone that comes over. But yeah, so it's an easy one for me as well. You know, obviously, Roy, you're going to pick the 10K too, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. I'll probably lose all of it if it was a sports card, right?
He's not lying.
That's good point. I was going to say the 2K, you could easily go down to zero. So... with the way the sports car market is, that's a good one. I'll revisit this next week when Roy's off the show, and then, you know, let's see if we still say the 10K. We're like, yeah, come on, guys, we're gonna go with the sports car, right?
For sure.
We just said that because Roy was on the show. Come on. No, I like that. All right, Hyung, do you want to go next?
Yeah, I'll go. So big hobby news in baseball. You guys know I'm big on Jackson Churio. He has a big time contract before he's even called up to the big leagues as a 20-year-old.
Oh, really?
Reportedly largest ever before his big league debut. So largest contract ever before his big league debut. I think it's 8-year, $80 million deal.
That's insane.
Yeah. So his card prices are on fire actually right now. A lot of people wanting it. And I'm going to pair him up with his Bowman Chrome first auto with our, you know, favorite here too, Ronald Acuna Jr. Bowman Chrome auto. Would you invest in a Bowman Chrome Acuna auto, which PSA 10 goes for $1,800, and the last sold for a Churio auto was actually $709 in bids, but that was a couple weeks ago. So let's just say it's $900 right now, maybe a little more. So would you go half the price of Acuna, or would you invest in our MVP?
So Churio is half the price of Acuna.
Churio is half the price right now of Acuna. So it just gives you an idea, though. Like, Acuna did a lot of stuff. Like, he's and I picked these two because I think they're very similar players. With Acuna, the only difference is Acuna may have 100%. He's defensively, he's going to be better. He has a better arm. But we're talking Churio's the 70 power. So, I mean, he could hit 30, 40 home runs in the big leagues every year as well. And swipe, he's a 70 speed as well. So.
Okay. I'll go first. I don't own any Acuna, and it's no knock on, he's obviously amazing. But either one of those cards for me is not going to be a keeper long term. I would use it to try and take advantage of a flip. So I think the Churio has the opportunity to gain that hype if and, you know, whenever he is about to make that step into the big show. So give me the Churio for that short term volatility. Yeah, Churio for me.
Yeah, that's keep going back and forth, but I think I'm going to go with Churio as well for the short term upside play, just like John mentioned. Because, you know, Acuna also, you know, he's one of those guys where when I'm in, he's going to get injured again. So I'm not like, oh, forget it. You know, like, you know, so I don't want to take that risk. And, you know, obviously there's risk with investing in young guys too, right? Who have never good
point,
played a
good point, Clark. Just to give you prove that point, out of the five or the four or so that signed a big contract before their MLB debut, here are the remaining that Churio surpassed. So Luis Robert, Eloy Jimenez, Scott Kingery, Evan White, John Singleton. So just to prove a point that, hey, there's not many that panned out there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going with Acuna. You know, I'll stay with the more stable.
Wow, that changed quick.
Roy, what do you think?
Yeah, like I would probably buy the Churio and then sell it after his first game. Like, hope he has a good first game and then sell it then. Because the way Bowman works, exactly. Like it just doesn't make sense. Like, these guys are paying top dollar for these kids that have never played or like are, you know. And then you have a guy like Acuna who's like MVP star, and like his value is good, but it's not even like that great. These kids are going for way more. So I'll do, short term, Churio. After, hope he has a good first game or like first home run, sell that card, and then.
Yeah. No, Before you go, Hyung,
I'll also go with Acuna because, you know, I've been seeing him in a lot of those Topps marketing campaigns. So, you know, he's a player in the baseball card space. I think he'll be a growing, you know, ambassador for Topps as well. So there you go.
Acuna. The popularity. Acuna did sign a really early deal, that $100 million 8-year deal too. But that was after his big league debut. But those are both. I think Acuna's $100 million deal is a steal for the Atlanta Braves. But I'm gonna agree with you guys. I think I like to match these 1v1s to kind of prove a point. Even though obviously, you know, long term, if you're to invest. It makes sense to invest in the Acuna, but it depends on how short your cycles are. And if you see opportunity where, hey, you know, I've seen these Bowman Chrome base autos go high at the right time. Volpe was a perfect example. Jason Dominguez, there's all these, you know, examples that we've seen in the past. So I'm going to go with Churio. He's 20 years old and he's turning 20 years old in March. So yeah. It's something that he could be in the big leagues this year or this in 2024. So to, you know, be able to, yeah, to me, it's cheerio for me. Yeah.
All right. Good one. Could have been a sweep, but then Hyung made me change my mind. So
that's why I baited you because I knew you guys are all like, let's do it for the flip and then buy a more expensive Pokemon card.
Yep. All right, John, do you want to end things off with your pick one?
Sure. So you guys know me. I'm going to go hypothetical 1v1. We talked about one of these cards a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to go a Junk Wax era Grail 1v1. So okay. 1990 Topps, Frank Thomas, no name PSA 10. Ooh, last right. sold for $170,000. I think that's what you said, Clark.
Holy.
Pop one. Versus the 1993 SP foil Derek Jeter. Ooh, PSA 10, pop 21, last sold for $200,000. Now I think if this was a collector question, probably be a fairly easy answer. So let's say from an investor perspective, if you got $200,000 lying around that mark, what is the better investment? The SP, Derek Jeter, PSA 10, or the Pop 1 Frank Thomas, no name?
It's a good one.
I'll go first. From a collector, it's easy. Derek Jeter, the SP foil.
Yes.
Looks way better. But from an investor perspective, I'm going to go with the Pop 1 Frank Thomas, no name. I think, what are the chances there's going to be Pop 2 for one? I'm sure PSA will be very strict on what passes for a PSA 10. Knowing the importance of that card. And, you know, Frank Thomas, I think he's in broadcasting too now, right? So I think he's going to become a little bit more popular, outside of his career. So I'm going to bank on that a little bit. You know, I know obviously Derek Jeter's into the broadcasting game as well. So they're both, you know, going to be relevant in the sports world. So that combined with the super rarity of the Frank Thomas no name, I'm going to go with that card as an investment piece.
Roy, I
like that same type of mindset of Pop 1 because you never know. Like Frank Thomas, yeah, again, he's in broadcasting. Something could happen. Like just having super rare card like a Pop 1 is absolutely crazy. And like, do you guys like know the print run of like this no name Frank Thomas card? It's probably pretty low, right?
400. So equivalent to like an SSP.
Yeah. And the Jeter, it was probably printed a lot, right?
Oh, like crazy.
Yeah. So like, like the Jeter, he's like, I know Jeter much more than I do Frank Thomas just because my age, just much baseball and being on the Yankees. Like, yeah, it's great to have a low pop card, but having a one of one pretty much of a print run of 400, like you can't get better than that. And like, it's not like Frank Thomas was a bum. He was a great player, right? So,
right.
He was okay. Yeah, no, like I just on that alone, like I think for me, Frank Thomas was a superior player. Obviously Jeter has his accolades and then the collectability of 93 SP is like a massive card for us collectors. But like that Frank Thomas card was iconic card for me, even growing up. Even now, I think it's an iconic card. I think in the future, it's going to be an iconic card. And with the print run of 400 and a pop one, like for me, it's a no brainer with the Frank Thomas. I don't know the pop count on the Jeter SP, but it's going to, do you 21. Guys want to pop 21? Yeah. So for me, I love rarity over anything, scarcity over current prices. So I'm going to go Frank Thomas as well.
There you go.
Wow. This one was tough because I think originally the Frank Thomas was easiest to think about, like pop one, Clark. You know, the three of us young, like the older guys, like that was an iconic card back in the day. And Frank Thomas for us was such a huge chase because Griffey, I missed out on 89 Griffey because when I kind of discovered Upper Deck, it was already 1990, 1991. and the 89 Griffey packs were just too expensive to buy. So immediately the chase became Frank Thomas. Like everyone knew Frank Thomas was like that next big name, kind of like collecting Zion Williamson. So I think it seems easy, but there's one thought that kind of popped in my mind as you guys were talking, and I'm going to actually go with the Jeter at 21 pop. I think it's, wow. I feel like it's rare enough. And Jeter is like this legend that I think is going to continue to live on in generations. Whereas the no name, I don't even, to be honest, I didn't even know. I get it's a pop one, but I'm shocked that it's $170,000 for a junk card. For a card, you know, the one with the name on it, you could buy it for like 10 cents, right? So I think that lore and that legend status of the Frank Thomas, it might die with our generation. I don't know if like Roy's generation and new collectors, it might be a bit too niche and tucked away to become a noticeable valued item in the future, right? Whereas the Derek Jeter SP, I think it's going to be one of these like Ichiro, like a legend within baseball and sports that continues to live on. And then his main rookie card continues to stand the test of time. So there's a bit of me, like in the next 10, 20 years, I think I feel like the Jeter is going to take off a bit more than the no name. So I'm going to go the Jeter.
Okay. Well, John pulled a John at the end. You know, we thought he was going to go big hurt, and then he went the captain. All right. Well, that's a good way to end the show. Again, Roy, thanks a lot for coming on to the pod. We appreciate your Pokemon knowledge, and hopefully you'll be back on the pod. Hopefully, you know, this experience didn't scare you off, but you know, I feel like the Pokemon market's going to just continue to grow, right? So it was very beneficial for us to hear and learn about Pokemon cards.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, and hopefully I was able to spread a little bit of knowledge. My mind might have been all over the place, but hopefully you guys got something out of it.
For sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, thank you to all our listeners who tune in every week. We'll have a brand new episode for you guys next week, Tuesday. And we'll see you then. Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to Cards to the Moon. We'd really appreciate you subscribing to our podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can also connect with each of us on Instagram at 5CardGuys, or you can follow Hyung at Integrity Sports Cards, or John at TradeU at Recess. You can also check us out at 5cardguys.com. Thanks again, and hope to connect soon.